everyone, and welcome to another episode of Getting Hammered. We have a special guest today, my friend Tim Carney, who's a columnist at the Washington Examiner and a father of six, way to go, has written a new book, Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be, and I want to ask him all about it. So welcome to the show, Tim Carney.
Thank you very much for having me.
I was excited to read this one, although I did not follow your instructions properly, and I have not banished my children for a long enough time to finish it yet. But I do love that it opens with, like, grab a beer and tell your children to go somewhere else so you can read this book. Because
Let them back in when they're if they're bleeding or really, really hungry. So, yeah.
It is. That's the way I was raised. And it's something that we attempt to do as parents. But tell me about where the idea for this book came from. I love the philosophy. I love the idea of it. Where was it birthed?
Probably while my wife and I were escaping our children during the lockdowns in 2020. So we were, you know, fake homeschooling our kids. Thankfully, we realized partway through that they weren't going to learn very much anyway, because we didn't know how to homeschool them. So we let them run a little wild. But it was a follow-up to my last book, Alienated America, 5 years ago, which said, sort of looking backwards, the biggest story of the last 60 years is the collapse of local community, of church going, of PTA joining, of bowling leagues, et cetera, a lack of belonging. And in Alienated America, by the end, I sort of concluded that the biggest consequence of that was the sort of the erosion of family in the U.S., so the reduction in marriage, the collapse in the birth rates. And so I gave an editor a call. I think they thought I said happy birthday. gave the editor a call, and he was like, I don't want you to wag your finger at people and say they should have six kids like you. I said, okay, how about I talk about what's causing people to either not want kids, to want fewer kids, or to conclude, while I do want three kids, it's just not in the cards. And so that's what I set about to figure out with the interviews, traveling around the country, combing through the social science data, and just thinking about my own life, extended family, community, et cetera.
Well, and as a jumping off point, on Twitter last night, there was a little dust up or a viral tweet where someone said, basically, two kids feels like 15 kids. I can't imagine what three kids feels like. And I am a mother of four, and I am friends with many people who have more than three children, you included. And I don't know if people think it's an op when we say this, but four is easier than two.
Yes. Yes.
Can you tell me about why that is?
Well, so the caveat, so we don't get hate mail. With each child, what got harder was the months when they're not sleeping, the weeks when they're not sleeping. And that might just be because we were older with each child. In other words, not sleeping through the night is a lot more bearable at 28 when I had my first than at 38. It might be because you're dealing with other kids. Past those months, after whatever it is, 6, 8, 9, 10, 12 months, when the baby's basically sleeping through the night, it gets easier for all sorts of reasons. And in fact, I've pitched the Washington Post on a piece called Make Your Life Easier, Have Four Kids, in part because there's data about this, that some of the polls suggested that three is the hardest number, because maybe at that point, you're still trying to keep everything together. And at four, you realize, okay, you need to A, stop doing some of the things that you thought you needed to do. B, the oldest at that point can care a lot. And you and I both were very smart, and we had girls first. And that really helps. And there's just, so you get the help from the oldest. You realize all the stuff that you don't need to do. You sort of give up on one term I encountered. We did focus groups for this book. And these guys all saying, I don't want to have kids until I can give them the best of everything. And you realize you want to give them the best of some things. Right. But you don't need to give them the best of everything. You don't need to give them the best lasagna. You can give them lasagna that, you know, isn't going to scald their mouth or poison them. You don't need to give them the best soccer team. You can give them the soccer team that's the closest to your house. And so that realization, I think, absolutely helps. But part of it is just surrender, realizing you're not going to do all the things you thought you had to do, and your kids probably can be better for it.
Well, and it's funny because a lot of us grew up with a lot less intensive parenting, and yet the culture has told us we should do it. And I have to fight my sort of I guess, the cultural winds around me, particularly in Northern Virginia, to say, like, we're not going to do every extracurricular activity. We're just not. Sometimes I feel like, am I giving them the proper opportunities? But you, there's a line in your book that I might use as my bumper sticker slash sampler cross stitch for my household, which is, it's not laziness, it's sanity. Once I have four kids, I can let go and let God on a couple things because it's just necessary. And that liberation.
Yeah. It's that liberation is better, not just for you, but for kids. So right, the last sentence I added to my book, and the publishers got so angry because I was past the deadline, but the study had just come out from the American, an op-ed, I should say, in the American Journal of Pediatrics saying the reason that kids are more anxious today is mostly the lack of independent play, you know, play without supervision by adults. That is, kids, you know, any one of these activities might be good for your kids. So you send them to school, that's good. You put them on a sports team, that's good. Playing violin, that's good. Chess club, that's good. It's not good when that's all that they have. So some of these activities, I argue in chapter one, aren't actually good. But for the most part, if these activities are good, if you don't let them, one woman told me, in my household, boredom is a muse. Like, that's where the kids get their creative stuff. It's where my kid taught himself to write in Dwarvish. I'm not arguing that that's a life skill. That's important, okay? But, like, and another thing is wandering the neighborhood. And, I mean, so, and that's something that we definitely did. Come home when the streetlights turn on. If you want dinner, you better be home by 6. And that's not done. Some of it is safetyism that makes people afraid of it. But some of it is this belief, well, that's a waste of time. There are things that kids can waste time on. I mean, when we let them watch TV, it's just for our sanity. And I do think 90% of the time, that's a waste of time. But being bored and wandering the neighborhood, that is definitely not a waste of time.
Yeah, I think we found some of that during the pandemic, during which time I was like semi-competently homeschooling them. But part of my homeschooling was, for these hours of the day, you're going to play together. And you're going to come up with projects. And maybe there's a subject that I sort of lightly throw in your direction that you need to like do work on. But they, since that time and sort of changing the expectations at our household, when they go off and are bored, and a part of that is like not having a ton of screen time, when they go off and bored, they come back with like a podcast script for a Barbie history podcast. And I'm like, this is actually quite good. I don't think I have time to produce it. But there's magic in those moments that we prevent otherwise.
Well, and the story I tell is of one of the things that's lost in over-supervised childhood is mixed age play. And you know exactly what I'm talking about. And anybody with more than two kids knows exactly what I'm talking about. But there's actually studies on this. So one of the funny things about writing Family Unfriendly was all the stuff that my mom just told me, I find backed up by social science data. Yeah. It's like, Tim, you read studies on how having kids around makes old people happier. It's like, you did not need to do that. But on mixed age play, one of the things, it explained how older kids and younger kids benefit from this. And so when we first moved to Virginia, we had a fifth grader and a first grader, and a kindergartner, the only two girls who were going to a school that was walking distance. And so then the other kids, they were driving distance. So when my wife was picking them up, the two younger ones would walk home from school, the fifth grader would make a snack, and then they would play. And my fifth grader was struggling with reading, learning disabilities. She became a better reader because she would just read to the kindergartner. And she got to be a big girl. She's a middle girl, so she got to be the big girl for a whole school year. She got to walk the kids home. And I will tell you, nothing makes the old folks in the neighborhood happier than seeing two girls in a Catholic school uniform, you know, walking your kindergarten little sister home. It's the best.
Well, and let's talk about the people in the neighborhood who might not be happy to see that, right? Yes. Because there is a demographic that like, oh, that's so nice, kids walking to school. But a lot of parents, I think, react to, as you were referencing safetyism, the idea, I'm not actually worried about my children when I send them out into the neighborhood, which I do. But I do worry that someone will call someone because they see my kids in the neighborhood. What advice do you have for people on that front?
So that's Katie, my wife's line exactly. Because I'm a little more free range than she is. When she finds out what I did, she's like, I'm not afraid of kidnappers. I'm afraid of Child Protective Services. And where we used to live in Montgomery County, Maryland, sure enough, there was a free range family that, you know, they trained their kids how to walk down to the park that was a mile away. And when people saw these kids trudging a mile, they said, clearly these kids are neglected. They call the police, the parents get investigated, the kids got separated for hours. Like, the only harm and trauma to the kids was this fear that they weren't going to get reunited with their parents. It was caused by the county of Montgomery. And so one of the things, though, is that you just have to, if the more you lead the way in a neighborhood, the more normal it becomes and the less likely somebody is to call. So we actually had a parent email me. She found my email from an old group email on the block and said, hey, look, I keep running into your kids on the playground. And I think it's great. I think it's great you send them out there. I'm not ready for it. And so, like, I would go out and I would talk to her and I'd be like, okay, yeah, this one is a little young and is a flight risk. So you have to worry about him, but the older girl, she's totally. And so the part of it is just nothing beats community, organic, knowing of your neighbors and that sort of thing. And I've been lucky. And I tell the stories of the times I lost Sean. There's one kid who I've lost three times. And when the cops found him the first time, they just thankfully just wanted to reunite him with the father. They didn't decide to press charges. I do think the tide has turned a little bit on that because of some of the negative publicity these police departments got. And some states are actually passing free range child laws. It started with Utah, others, places like Connecticut that have had absurd, you know, you had to be 14 to babysit your younger sister, now is, you know, getting rid of some of those rules. Right. So a lot of these places, I think even that fear, just like the fear of kidnapping, the fear of CPS is overblown. The fear of a snooty neighbor, you're going to have to judge that on a case-by-case basis, but that can be handled.
I do feel like, I think we're a little lucky in our neighborhood, partly because we have a lot of Army families around us who very much know how to create community because they often have deployments that they have to live through and they have to have resources elsewhere. So I think that's an upside for us because it has a little bit of a throwback vibe. But we have found, just to encourage people also, that when we send our kids out into the neighborhood, and we do have a concession to modernity, we give them those little gizmo watches that they can call us if they need to. But when they go out and they recruit, basically, we tell them we tell them to politely refuse invites inside to do screen time, which is what a lot of kids will say. We said then politely refuse and just ask if the kids want to come outside and play with you. And we have gotten fairly good response, and a lot of parent has thought we were insane.
No, that's great. And because in my old neighborhood, when my son did meet boys his age and he found out where they lived and tried to like say, hey, let's go play soccer, they just wanted to play, you know, FIFA World Cup. And I should have pushed him to be like, hey, no, let's go outside, or even lobby the dad. Hey, don't you want your kids to come outside?
And what about the safetyism part where the parents are actually anxious about sort of low percentage threats, right? You know, as a mom, I have to fight this again inside myself because I do worry, right? Things can go the worst way possible occasionally. So how do you sort of govern that part of it? I found during the pandemic, I got better at it because looking at COVID and looking at data helped me to feel better about our family's risk profile. But a lot of people went the other direction.
Oh, yes. So a lot of that obviously is emotional, and from parents and more so from mothers, it's I wouldn't forgive myself. In other words, if you feel like you could have done something better. So it's different than, you know, you got struck by lightning while standing in the front yard. It's I did let her wander the neighborhood when I had this gnawing doubt. But so first of all, it's a one in a million chance that any child would be abducted by a stranger. It feels much more present because whenever it happens, it's in the news.
Right.
And so in our sort of in our minds that have not evolutionarily evolved to mass media yet, it seems like it's happening all around us all the time. One thing is you can't prevent horrible things from happening. Like there's not, when these bizarre abductions do happen, it's not because the parents are negligent. It's because the kid's doing something perfectly normal. And again, it almost never happens. It is literally as likely that your child will be struck by lightning. And the other thing is that to just think about what the actual risks are and that there are trade-offs. So I use the example of leaving kids in a car. On a hot day, you don't leave your kids in a car. You don't leave a newborn in the car. You don't leave them in a car in a dangerous neighborhood. But if you've got a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old and you're just running in and out, crossing the parking lot might actually be more dangerous.
Yes.
And so my wife luckily didn't have the kids with her the time she just got mowed down by a guy who just wasn't paying attention in a parking lot. Gosh. And she ended up in the emergency room. And, you know, I don't even know what happened to the groceries. I need to ask her that. Presumably we lost all the groceries because she was just carrying them in her hand when she got hit. But if she had been holding the hands of a kid, it would have been worse. So that fact that there's trade-offs, and we don't see that. We only see the costs, the risks on one side. And so being in a car to go to a big park is a lot more dangerous than letting your kids run unaccompanied at that big park. And I freak out about, you know, swimming pools and the ocean and drowning, because that actually is the way that accidental deaths happen. But falling off of a playset is not statistically in any way a significant one.
Especially not these days. As I tell parents, like, these play spaces are nerfed within an inch of their lives. Like, they're going to fall on like a cloud.
But I will say this. The playground, I don't know if you notice this, or you might actually be just enough younger than me that you were on the really bad end of this. When I was a kid, the playgrounds were these awesome splintery wooden structures.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then when I was in high school, I noticed they were all being replaced by these really lame, super safe things. And then when my kids came around, they had improved. Like, they were kind of built so you could climb on the outside of it and do slightly more dangerous things. And I realized kids actually need risks. Kids actually need at least something that feels like a risk.
Yeah,
and
I do
think deprive them of that.
We're coming around to more of like a treehouse vibe that's very, you know, taller structures, a little more climbing. There was actually a merry-go-round in our neighborhood in Delray, which for those who don't know is like the Park Slope of Northern Virginia. It's like as liberal as it gets. And there was a merry-go-round in 2015 that was fast as hell. And I was like, I don't know how this has gotten under everyone's radar, but I got to teach my kids to play on it ASAP before they rip it out of here. It was gone within a year. So, you know, we do what we can. Yes. I actually thought about, could I dig it up and put it in my backyard? but I did not make good on that. Tell me a little bit about, and this is something I haven't been great at because I'm not much of a planner, but like, you talk about creating spaces for parents and kids to come together, and your line is to come together and ignore the kids. The adults should be able to have freedom in those spaces. Tell me a little bit about how you created some of those spaces and what that looked like in your community.
So that usually involves leveraging the connections that you already have to institutions. So for me, it happened at our old Catholic parish in Montgomery County, Maryland, where the priest just was sort of figuring out what the parish should do and said, what do all the people in this room need that the rest of the world isn't giving them on a day-to-day basis? And that's when I said what you just said. We need a place to bring our kids and ignore them while we run around. So we came up with this idea of a Friday night T-ball program where T-ball was just an excuse. One year, I didn't even touch the T-balls. I just ran the grills, and they were all funded by donations. Because we had this sort of back campus in the middle of the suburbs where the teenagers could all, you know, hang out in one corner, kids could play basketball, little kids were on the playground with slightly older kids who were too old for T-ball, and the parents just lounged. And so the idea was, it was totally low stakes. Like, this is not high level T-ball. This is $0. There's no signing up. You come when you come. And we just wanted to make it the default. So families who would graduate from T-ball, they didn't have any kids in there. They just kept coming back. It was one less night on the family planning schedule for mom or dad. And it was just a place to be. And so again, but that didn't involve, you know, any massive planning on my part. It involved me asking the pastor and the school principal if we could do it. And then there's a shed and there's bats. And one day a bunch of dads show up and we, you know, we fix what needs to be fixed. And so that's why community, why belonging to things is so important. Because you're only able to pull those things off if you're plugged into an institution.
Yeah, there's a moment where you say that a mom left her kid on the playground and grabbed a Miller. And that is truly my vision for other moms. Like, I want them to have those moments. And, you know, I'm, you know, obviously I have more experience talking to moms than dads. I'm sure dads feel it equally. But there is this tendency to get just so overwhelmed when in fact parenting can offer all this joy. I have so much fun with my children. And I think for me, perhaps, you know, I was widowed when my second child was on the way, and I had to let go of the idea I was going to do things perfectly very early, right? Mm-hmm. It was like, we can do what we can do. And I think even though that was such a sad circumstance, that gave me a window into greater joy to be had from my kids than I would have had maybe otherwise if I had felt all this pressure to be perfect.
No, and that's, you know, school nights for me, just the, so I have high schoolers now, and so to hear them not doing their homework and that kind of thing. And then the other day I was like, I got annoyed, and then I realized what I was listening to was them laughing while he, the ninth grader, was making up a song on the guitar. And I was like,
nice.
I mean, I'm, do not let my high schoolers listen to this podcast, but that was better than homework. Them goofing around and making up a jokey song, this 11th grade girl and ninth grade boy on a school night, was the right thing to be doing. The other thing that I mentioned a tiny bit in the book, but I thought about more recently, is it's important for them to see you having fun. Because for me, what I, the chapter one of my book is titled "Have Lower Ambitions for Your Kids," but I don't actually have low. I have low ambitions for their baseball, their, you know, what college they get into. I don't expect them to go to Ivy Leagues or anything, but I do want them to share our faith and to have families and to surround themselves with love. And I think when they look at the life that me and Katie have, like at the backyard barbecues, we're having fun while they're having fun. They are the ones who are like, Mom, Dad, let's go. Stop talking to your friends. It's
Yeah, you mentioned while we're on the subject of that having fun, that there are oases from this family unfriendly culture. What do some of those look like in different contexts, and what do they have in common?
So when I lived in Maryland, the neighborhood right next door was called Kemp Mill. It's anchored by two Orthodox synagogues. You'd call modern Orthodox synagogues. And so, but you know, they observed the prohibition on walking, on driving during the Sabbath. So everybody lives within walking distance.
Right.
And then you throw in the shared faith, and all of a sudden, they're certainly just liberated children. Definitely on the Sabbath when none of them are doing scheduled activities. But it trickles out into the other 6 days of the week too, just because they get used to walking. They get used to sort of the kids showing up at, and there are dads who would talk about walking into their own house and there's eight kids and they can't find their own because their own are somewhere else. And that just sounded like this little slice of heaven. But also parents had the authority, the sort of implicitly delegated authority, to discipline somebody else's kid if their parent wasn't around, which is an old-fashioned thing that can get you into trouble in some places. I talk about our own social lives, Catholic schools where six families aren't that surprising, and we don't have the walkability. In fact, we're scattered around the whole Washington Beltway area, but we do have the schools, the events, that sort of thing, where first of all, just financially, half the events are $10 a person, $20 a family. So wow. I show up instead of it. You know, I once went to a county fair where I spent $100 just to get in on the 50% off night. And here I'm spending $20. And just, but the expectation that you will bring your kids, the desire that you're going to bring your kids is part of that. I went to Utah and Idaho where the college students are, a lot of them have kids. I saw one student running down the hallway, obviously late for class, panicking, looking around where to drop off his kid who was in the stroller. And one of his buddies in the student union was like, all right, Dave, bring the baby over here. Like, yeah. I will watch it while I'm trying to study. And then Israel was the biggest one. One guy put it, the bus drivers in Israel have a real affection for little kids and just to have kids anywhere. So the common thread in all of these is religion.
Yeah.
I am sure that there are non-religious communities, probably, you know, neighborhoods that center around a public school, that sort of thing. But on a bigger level, something that would actually show up on a map, everyone that existed like that was a religious and was a religiously centered community.
Yeah. You talk about various obstacles that we face, right, in building a more family-friendly culture. One is that religiosity has dropped off pretty crazy rates. With it has the birth rate as well, right? Mm-hmm. So these are like, these are large problems, large cultural problems with the way that we view dating and sex, and perhaps screens and technology are involved.
Yep.
And then there's also the walkability problem. So there's two different things. One that could be like a public policy addressed issue, and others that are these huge overarching cultural issues. What approach should we be taking, right? Does piecemeal policy stuff actually help on the margins?
I think every little thing helps, because so many of the problems I describe, people say, well, is that the cause of the anxiety and the falling birth rates or a result? And I say usually both. So spin it the other way. So one section I have is on the need for more stay-at-home parents, which will mostly mean stay-at-home moms. Yeah. When you have more of them, then there will, it will be easier for the rest, for the next one to come in. There will be more infrastructure. It'll be more just moms at the playground, moms at the coffee shop during the day. And similarly with all the other things, you make a town a little more kid walkable and kid bikeable, which I contrast to hipster walkability, which is
right.
Being able to stumble home from your cocktail bar, the kid being able to you know, ideally there's a 7-Eleven or a job he can ride his bike to like I did when I was 14. But more important, it's a playground, his friend's house, the ball field. The crosswalks are small enough that little kids can cross the streets, and the speed limits are slow enough that kid walkability and bikeability, that will lead to more kids, which will lead to more kids being on the street, which will lead to sort of the whole nature of the neighborhood being more kid friendly. So every little thing like that can help. I do spend a big chunk. I have a chapter say, should Uncle Sam subsidize families? Because that's where so much of the policy discussion these days is focused, is child tax credit, child care credit. I don't think that's that promising. I defend a child tax credit slightly bigger than the current one. Child care subsidies are a waste of money, in my opinion. If you've got the money, just turn into a bigger check to the parents.
Right.
Child care subsidies subsidize work rather than family. If you give somebody a child tax credit, they can spend it on a child care center. They can spend it on a nanny. They can spend it on building a granny flat for her to come in. Or what a lot of women, what most mothers would do with a little more money is they would dial down their own work to being 25 hours a week from home, so they're there when the school bus drops off.
Yeah, that's the thing that, I mean, this is anecdata, but in my personal little focus group of mom friends who are, I would say, you know, normie, not super political, mm-hmm. centrist, like center right, a lot of them, but a couple center left and liberal women, for them, they're very comfortable, if possible, making the trade-off that I have more flexibility and maybe I make less money, but mm-hmm. what part of what they got out of the pandemic was having a little bit more of that available to them, which it turned out made them happier in a lot of instances.
And so, but they learned that through an experience.
Yeah.
What I see from women on the other side, there's this one woman I quote in the book. She was here at AEI as an intern or something. And after I gave sort of a practice talk while I was in the middle of writing this book, she said, I would like to get married and have kids. The reason I don't think I will is having kids, I would necessarily take some step away from work. My career would lag. I would then be financially dependent on my husband. And then if our marriage were to fall apart, I would be very vulnerable. And I just thought, what you're describing is building a career as a financial insurance product. And you're mm-hmm. describing then, for the sake of a financial insurance product, giving up something else that you really want, which is a family.
And that's many steps of catastrophizing as well before you get to the end
but
result.
That planning mindset is such a part of the modern mind, I think. The idea that you can plan the future. That's why I quote Mike Tyson in the book. Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the mouth.
Right.
I don't know if you had birth plans. Like,
Yeah.
And then it's like, oh my gosh, there's blood, there's pain. What the heck are we doing here? And it's the same with your kids. But that idea that you can plan, so in the end of the book, I get towards that idea that you can like sterilize and make nice and clean and orderly your whole life is a mistake. It's certainly a mistake if you want to have a fun life. And that's one of the joys of having kids is you say, all right, plans out the window.
For someone like that, who's like looking down the barrel of a very like unfriendly dating culture, I get it. particularly if you want a family that you hope will end up being stable. I think the drop off in religiosity and religious observance then like opens the door to the possibility that young woman was talking about, which is like, what if I am stuck on my own? So I understand that fear. Are there remedies in the dating culture for addressing that?
I am much better at describing the problems in the dating culture, in part because I got married before the apps came out. The problem that like it's bad to ask somebody out in person or to ask out a friend of a friend because you haven't done the double secret consent that happens in the apps. That just to me is so inhuman and it throws up a roadblock. And I would think you have to sort of, I mean, I still think you can do what I did, which is when I lived in a bachelor pad, my New Year's resolution in 2003 was to throw a party every month. The purpose of these parties was to meet a girl. And sure enough, in August, at my birthday, up shows, you know, a girl brings a friend of a friend who now is the mother of my six kids. And we have two dogs in addition. Like this is, it works to meet through friends of friends is what I would say. But yeah, the things I encountered when talking to single younger millennials and to Gen Zers about the dating landscape, I do think it's a combination of the apps and some aspect of modern feminism and this planning mindset all get in the way of what you need, which is surrender and sacrifice. The being married, being a parent involves giving up some of your autonomy. As I said, it's becoming more like an internal organ, which is totally dependent on the other internal organs. When you get specialized a little bit, specializing makes you vulnerable. And vulnerability nowadays, I think, is seen almost as a pathology. I quote Christine Emba from her book, Rethinking Sex. I don't know if you've read that or had her on, but she was basically a liberal millennial who suddenly looked around at the landscape. I was like, this is not working. We value independence above all else. Right. And that means connection is out the window.
Right. Which then leads to the understandable relationship and sexual connection problems that you see in all of these surveys. One of the things that always jumps out at me, because I have normal mom anxieties about like how your teenagers are going to act someday. They're going to be wild. And it turns out teenagers aren't wild, almost to like a shocking and problematic degree. They don't take risks.
Yes. The sort of failure to launch problem, a disordered passivity is what Yuval Levin, my boss at AEI, calls it. And part of it is if you are upper middle class, you know, organization kid trying to get into Princeton, you don't tolerate any risks. And part of it for working class kids who might only have one parent or whatever, there's, you know, the passivity that video games and the apps and the cell phones bring on. And in either event, there's just, you did not think that there would be people, parents worrying that the kids aren't making out enough on a Friday night.
it's a new one for me. But you note also that, and this is an argument I make to liberals and when I have friendly discussions with them about these things, is that, you know, I got four kids. You need them as your tech space if you want to do any of the things that you guys want to do. But you have a whole chapter about how we can't afford the baby bus.
Yes. So just since we haven't talked numbers yet, when we first started having kids, there was 4.3 million babies born in the U.S. in 2006, 2007. Last year, there was about 3.6. Less than 3.6. We've fallen from 4.3 to 3.6. That's 15-20%. And so that at the same time, the total fertility rate, which is a birth rate number you normally see, it was a little above 2.1, which gets called the replacement level. That can allow a population to keep its current size. 2.1 back before the baby bust started, down to 1.6, 1.7 now. As a result, there are actually fewer children in America today by number than there were a decade ago. There are more Americans in their 60s than there are under the age of 10. So the working age population has kind of flatlined. It will start dropping in the next 20 years. And so when you and I retire, not that we're ever going to retire, but when you and I, you know, are only able to to do podcasts and not to write because our eyesights are gone. There will be nobody we can call to like fix our broken windows because the working age population is shrinking. And so you could talk about Social Security and that sort of thing. But for me, it's just the productive capacity will go down. Right. And all of that, though, is secondary. In my mind, the real moral, social, emotional costs of not having enough kids are big. It just makes people have less hope for the future. And it will spiral out of control. These countries where the birth rate falls enough below 2.1, it then starts accelerating.
Well, yeah, and you're right that there's all these studies which, you know, handily confirm my priors, but also there are these studies, like both your grandmother, your mother, and I were all right. But there's all these studies that shockingly show these sadness rates, sort of this cultural desperation, and I think it got much worse during the pandemic years because of isolation and all sorts of other things. And I try to do my little part by expressing regularly in public how much fun I have being a mother to my children. And some people suggest that like maybe that's part of the solution. Like there needs to be more of this messaging that, hey, this is a really fun and fulfilling endeavor, not just a heart-wrenching, self-sacrificing, you know, ritual that I'm going through.
Yes. And so, I mean, I do talk about social media, the two destructive parts of the momosphere. One is, I guess these days, there's this woman who makes homemade like grilled cheese sandwiches and homemade cornflakes for her kids while being a model. And I don't think a lot of people actually think that's a normal thing, but I think it subconsciously might deter non-models who are uninterested in doing that from having kids. Or it might even deter them from being stay-at-home moms. The other side is that parenting is hell. Social media, which is big, which I didn't even know about because of the way the algorithm works. And so I did my research. I think Bethany Mandel was the one who was like, these are the three people to follow to see how absurd it gets. And it was pretty dark and pretty harrowing. But specifically for dads, I think there's the same problem, the same need you're describing, but in a different way. I was at a hearing on Capitol Hill the other day, and this one Republican staffer, you know, stood up and she said, what can we do to bring about a more equitable distribution of domestic caregiving? And I thought, stop talking that way. I have no interest in domestic caregiving. I love playing with my kids. I love making them a hot breakfast. Like I actually like experimenting with the different things and the burritos. And then you come up with a different name to lie to them about what you're giving to them. All that stuff I love. Destroying my 9-year-old in one-on-one basketball is amazing. And so it's fun to do this stuff. But the sort of the narrative, the discourse about toxic masculinity, and then the reaction, which brings in the actual toxic masculinity, that if I have modern feminism or Andrew Tate as my options, what's being left out is the devoted husband who loves being a dad. And so like dadliness, which is different from momliness. Now there's a million kinds of momliness, there's a million kinds of dadliness, right? But the essence of them are different. That needs its own exaltation. And you do see a lot of that, a lot of good, wholesome dadliness, more in sort of religious circles, but it needs to be more broadly put out there. I mean, Jim Gaffigan is a great guy at doing that.
I would suggest a new model for this is Jason Kelsey, actively talks about his wonderful wife and his wonderful family life and his wonderful children.
And he cries about them, but then also talks about how they're fun. So he's both emotional and
It's very nice. See, I think he might be a decent model for this, even with the luchador mask and the hard partying. Look, he's having fun. That's what he's doing.
Yes.
All right. I know you have to run. Am I missing anything big? Because I am unabashedly an evangelist for this point of view, and I want to spread it far and wide.
So so much of the book, I argue about, the reason I use the phrase about how our culture makes family raising kids harder is because I think there's lots of things we can do to make it easier. Changing the norms, paving sidewalks, that kind of thing. But it will always be, no matter what. Raising children will be the hardest thing you ever do if you do it. But I think it's important to realize it's the easiest path if where you're trying to get is somewhere worthy enough. That is, if you want to be a man or a woman of virtue, I think this is like a cheat code. I say it's a cheat code for sainthood in my Catholic terminology. That when the Bible says, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, we wake up and there are hungry, naked people in our house.
All over the place.
So easy to feed and clothe. Maybe yes. Not matching, but to feed and clothe them. And it's right there. And so that's sort of my last inspirational message there. And we do need to turn it around. It's not mostly going to be through subsidies, mostly going to be through doing what you're talking about, making it a little easier, making it more fun. But also saying, you know what? Sacrificing for other people is really what will make us happy in the long run.
Yep. Well, everybody check it out. It's Family Unfriendly by Tim Carney. How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Get it anywhere you get books. You will enjoy it. Thank you so much for being with me, Tim. Oh, and tell people where they can follow you.
On Twitter at TP Carney, The Washington Examiner, AEI.org at the American Enterprise Institute.
Awesome. Thank you so much. And thanks to your wife, Katie, for really, you know, doing some heavy lifting of her own.
She did a lot of that. So, yeah.
All right. Take care, Tim.
Thanks.